And our dream and our desire and our plan was to adopt a healthy infant. But God had a different plan, and he took us on a journey of heartbreak that completely opened our eyes to a whole new world of foster care. And he completely changed our perspective when he taught us it's not about bringing a child into our family. It's about bringing our family to a child. We became foster parents to three siblings who ultimately needed adoption, and so we adopted them as well. And last year in April, we brought home our seventh child named Friday, not the day of the week, the child, Friday, from Uganda. The other night at dinner, we were sitting around and we told our kids, guys, just listen. Okay, so unless God is super clear about this, we are done adopting. We are done having children. And one of our eight-year-old who had been adopted piped right up and said, "Phew, I'm sure glad I made it in time." Oh, there were difficult times, and there still are, of course, and bonding takes time. It is scary and it is unsettling, especially when you're a new adoptive or foster parent, when you realize that the feelings of love that maybe you have for your biological child or your child who's been there longer, that you don't necessarily feel that same emotional love for a child. And that's very scary and it's very unsettling. I found, and I've heard that you question yourself a lot. I remember often thinking, is this an adoption issue, or is this a boy issue, or is this a age issue, or is this just it? You know, what is this? But it was always, is this an adoption? You question yourself, and that's hard, and that's unsettling. And oh, the guilt, right, that you can feel when you have negative feelings towards a child, especially a child who you've waited for and you longed for and you've prayed for and you've had friends welcome them at the airport, and then they come home and you don't like them. Or you don't feel that bond and you feel guilty about that because you think, I wanted this. I waited for him. I waited for her. I can't feel this way. And guilt is just a nasty beast, right? There's nothing good about guilt. Or dealing with hard emotional stuff, the tears and the pain, the anger and the outbursts and the rage that come from our kids who have had a difficult past or who have just had a past that they don't have answers to. The unknowns can produce anger and pain and hurt. And that's hard. And it's hard to deal with as a parent. And especially when you think of foster care, it's very vulnerable. You are constantly preparing your heart to say goodbye. I remember when we first became foster parents, we had already been adopted parents, and yet I felt lonely as a foster parent because it was different. With adoption, you are committed to that child. With foster care, you don't know how long that child is in your home, and so you are constantly preparing your heart to say goodbye. And loving them like you're the mom, but realizing I'm not the mom. And I need to respect the mom and say every week, kids, you get to go see your mom this week. Yay! When inside you're hurting. But through it all, God is faithful. He has called you to this, and you know this in your head. But sometimes you don't feel it. And that's where we need the church. We need you to come alongside us and remind us that it is worth it. That we are where we're supposed to be. So that we never, ever, ever give up. So I'm going to end here with three very practical strategies to help you create a culture in your church where foster and adoptive families thrive. Number one, be a voice of encouragement. This can be as simple as sending notes of encouragement with a gift card. I remember standing in my kitchen reading a gift card or a note with a Starbucks gift card in it and just sobbing because someone said, "I see you," and go treat yourself to a cup of coffee. Please refrain from giving unsolicited advice. For the adoptive or foster parent who's struggling, I am telling you, a well-meaning comment, piece of advice can feel like a smack on the face. It is hard. Do not give advice if you haven't been there. Love them. Come alongside. Be careful not to demean the children's birth parents or their worker. Your job is to encourage that foster parent to stay the course. And welcome their children into your church with open arms. Let them know you are so happy to see them. Number two. So number one, be a voice of encouragement. Number two, make it simple to accept help. The goal is to show these families that you care. But it is important to note that when you are helping a foster or adoptive family, especially one who is struggling, telling them what you need or coordinating or asking them what they need or making them coordinate some of those small details can actually become more of a burden than a blessing. And so it becomes easy for them to just not accept help because it actually becomes a little more difficult than it is helpful. But show them you are serious about serving them. For example, offer to babysit, but take it a step further. Say, I have this day here, this day, put some dates on the calendar. I'm willing to give you my social security number, whatever you need, especially in foster care, so that you can get this approved. Then follow up. You know, I'd have people say, hey, I'd love to help you sometime. But is that real? Do they really want to help me? I'm not sure, so I'm not going to ask them again. Show them you're serious about serving. Coordinate delivery of meals. Here's a tip. Place a cooler outside their front door. Assign one point person. Let folks know to place a meal in the cooler and then text the family that you're there and leave. When someone's in the middle of transition and struggling, even coming to the door to accept a meal and thank you is hard and they would rather say no. That's not for every case, but when you're struggling, put it in the cooler, text them that it's there, and get out of there. The goal is to help. Coordinate laundry pickup and drop off. It can be very vulnerable to have someone to wash your underwear, but I'm telling you, get over it, foster and adoptive families. Put the laundry on the doorstep. Let them come and pick it up and let them bring it back to you on the doorstep again. We're talking in the middle of transition struggle. I have someone who comes and folds my laundry, and it's amazing and beautiful and wonderful, and I'll stop about that now. Step into the mess, number three. During our foster and adoptive experience, especially foster experience, one of our little ones came with head lice. And I remember I was so exhausted by it. And we were going to go on a date, and I had to text the family and say, I'm sorry, we have head lice. And she responded back, oh, we're still coming. And I'm telling you, I just sobbed because what she said to me is, I don't care. I'm willing to step into your mess with you because I care about you. And we got to go out. An older couple in church who had grandkids of their own called us up several times and said, we want to babysit so you can go out. They followed through. A church arranged a foster parent night out where we could actually leave the children and get out of there. Okay? Those are some great things. In conclusion, foster and adoptive parenting is messy. And we are not called or equipped to do it alone. We need you, the church. We need you to become the voice of encouragement. We need you to make it simple for us to accept your help. And we need you to be willing to step into our mess. And not only, I believe, will you create a church where culture, where families thrive, but you're also going to help other people to see, I can do this too. And you're going to see more people step up as well. Thank you.
Hey, fantastic. So we've got one more. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back in here. I want to introduce you to Ryan North from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Leads a ministry there called Tapestry that has a rich, 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 deep legacy and reputation for serving and supporting families in fantastic ways. So, Ryan, you'll finish us out. Like now. And then if you'll just dismiss us.
I was just building anticipation, that's all. I have heard many wonderful and inspiring things, but the thing that has resonated with me the most is when Michelle said, statistics make me feel so good. Because I love numbers too. Some years ago, one of the elders at our church was heading home from work, and as he crossed through an intersection, another car jumped the intersection and went straight into the side of his car. How many of you have ever been in a car accident? Right. And so this next part's going to make sense to you because he was sitting trapped in the vehicle, and while he waited for the fire department to come and cut him out of the car, he could smell the fuel. And when you smell the fuel, because there's a place called Hollywood in California, you think your car's going to explode. And so by the time the fire department got there, Jay was freaking out. And, get me out of here, get me out of here, get me out of here, he was yelling. And as they were cutting on the driver's side of the car, one of the other firefighters climbed in the passenger window and got in the car and covered him with a foil blanket and said, hey, buddy, buddy, he looked at me, he did his Purvis impersonation, buddy, give me your eyes. And Jay looked at him and he said, look, They're doing the best they can to get you out of here as fast as they can. But I want you to know this, that I'm here with you, and we are both getting out of this car, or we are not getting out of this car. That story always makes me, I can feel the emotional response in my arm when I tell that story, because a stranger climbed into a car with another stranger and said, from this moment forward, our fates are intertwined. Your outcome is my outcome. We are in this together, and we are getting out of this together. When you decided to become foster and adoptive parents, the day your first child arrived in your home, you said, we are in this together. From this moment forward, your fate is my fate. Your destiny is my destiny. We will get out of this thing together. The moment you chose to run a ministry, you said to foster and adoptive families, we're in this together. Your outcome is my outcome. Our destinies are intertwined. Everybody in this room and everybody that's ever read the Bible can quote James 1:27, right? To minister to widows and orphans in their distress. I think that the word in is the most compelling word in that verse, because it requires us to climb into the car. It requires us to get into their distress. So I think you need two things in order to climb into the car with the families that you serve. And one of them is that you need programs in place that equip and support people for the journey. Okay, you need programs in place that equip and support people for the journey. The other thing you need is that you yourself need to be prepared for the journey. And what I mean by that is that your stuff cannot get in the way of you helping other families. As rosy as your childhood may seem, if it was butterflies and unicorns, folks, there are issues from your past that will get in your way. Unresolved issues become buttons that people can push. And when your buttons are being pushed, you cannot help anybody with what they need from you. With all respect to the big mouse who lives down the street, the past is not in the past. It influences where you are today. It does not have to determine where you end up, but it does influence where you are today. You cannot let your stuff get in the way of helping families, because the things they do and the choices they make will scratch something from your history and will influence how you respond to them, and will not be the best response that they need. When I was a child, my dream job was to be an airline pilot. I just thought it was just the most romantic thing you could do, fly up in the clouds every day of your life. I've since met airline pilots, and they think there's no romance in it involved at all anymore. But when I was a five-year-old boy, I wanted to be an airline pilot. And so my dad traveled a lot for work, and every time he'd come home, he would go down on one knee and say, Daddy's home. And I'm saying, that's nice. Give me the in-flight magazine. And I couldn't yet read properly, but I would go to the page where they had the fleet of the airline, and I would memorize all the planes. I would memorize all the seating configurations. I could tell you the best place to sit. That still influences whenever we fly anywhere. We go to Seat Guru at the gate if we're on Southwest and pick the best. Never mind. But here's the thing about that. I don't like to fly. It terrifies me. Being separate. I'm not feeling very supported right now. It terrifies me. And here's a typical Ryan travel experience. Because I like going places. I'm glad to be in Orlando. But the day of travel will arrive. And we'll go to the airport. And we'll park the car. And I'll open my door. And then two things overwhelm my senses. Number one, the sound of jet engines. And number two is the smell of jet fuel. And I can feel my anxiety spike. And we get into the terminal. And I can feel my anxiety spike. We print our boarding passes. And my anxiety spikes. And we get a security, and my anxiety spikes. I am happy when the line is long at the TSA, because I know that I have a little break from my anxiety. And then we get through the government security check. And then my anxiety spikes a couple of notches, because if I chicken out and then realize I have to do it in any case, that's a big thing to undo. And then we get up the stairs and get to the gate, and my anxiety spikes again. And then the words that I've been dreading all day get uttered. Now boarding flight 1311 to Orlando. And I hand them my boarding pass, and I get to the plane, and I sit in my seat. And by this time, I'm breathing real shallow and fast. I'm bordering on a panic attack. I can feel perspiration running down my face. I feel hot. I have not spent 1 minute of my life as a Roman Catholic, but I'm praying and crossing myself. And my wife lets me fly with a bottle of peace and calming essential oil. I rub it on my wrists, on the back of my neck. They push back from the gate. Bruce just gave me a dollar and then threw my phone on the ground. But I push back from the gate and my anxiety spikes again. And I'm thinking, where else can your anxiety go, boy? And then they turn at the bottom of the runway and my plane accelerates. And now I'm holding on for dear life. I've got headphones on with loud, obnoxious music. And I'm reading at the same time because I want to overwhelm my senses. And the plane rotates and it goes and I can feel all of the gravity that aircraft is fighting against, I can feel in my chest. And I can't breathe and I can't expand my chest. That's how I fly. 1 year ago, we were traveling to Nashville, and on that plane ride, a man about four rows in front of me was choking. And so they quickly hit the flight attendant call button, and this little woman about four foot 10 inches tall came down and did the Heimlich in the aisle and dislodged what was blocking this man's airway. When we got home, my parents were watching our kids on that trip, and my dad said, "How was your trip?" And I told him the story about the man choking. And he didn't respond to me. He looked at my mother and he said, "Do you remember that time when Ryan was three and he choked on an airplane?" Oh. And she said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you remember how they had to help him?" She said, "Yeah, I kind of forgotten about that. But yeah, he's about 3 years old." And I said, "Why has nobody told me this?" I want to pause there for a second before I continue, because sometimes even when you thought your childhood had no issues, your body remembers what your brain doesn't. And that's why sometimes resolving your issues is going to take coffee with a friend, speaking to your parents, speaking to somebody called counselor. So 2 days later, I saw my friend Melanie Chung Sherman, and I told Melanie the story, and she hit me. She's a therapist. I don't think you're allowed to hit people in therapy sessions, but if you're just talking to them, they can. And she says, "Yes, that's, of course that's your problem, Ryan, because your body has this narrative that it believes. Bad things happen to Ryan on airplanes, and you're just waiting for the bad thing to happen. That's why you're so tense." A month later, we flew to CAFO up in Nashville, and we're on Southwest Airlines, and as we get on the plane, there are two seats that I can see as we're walking down the aisle. They're open on the wing, on the window in the center, the middle seat. And as the crowd parts, Melanie is sitting on the aisle on that row. So my next plane ride, I got to take with my therapist. A few of you have that privilege. I did. And so we kind of talked through some stuff. And I'm happy to report that I've probably flown 20 times since then. I can now actually make it onto the plane. The essential oils don't travel with me anymore. I can actually take off without listening to music now. Flying through turbulence doesn't bother me because I was made aware of something and I dealt with it. Now, that was a fun story. Here's why it matters. My six children are in Orlando this week because we're going to go visit the Disney World this weekend. My seven-year-old daughter is a very high-anxiety child, and she sat next to me on the plane because she's also the daddiest of all daddy girls in the world. So we decided, as we assigned seats, that she'd sit next to Dad. We got on the plane. She was really excited about going to Disney. She'd never flown before. She sat down. She buckled her seatbelt. She grabbed my arm, and she started sobbing. And I said, "What's the matter, baby?" She said, "Daddy, I'm scared." I said, "Sweetie, we're just sitting here." She said, "Daddy, I'm scared. I don't know if I can fly. I don't want to do this. I think I want to get off the plane." So what did I do? We got the peace and calming from Mom. I put headphones on her with loud music. And I said, "Play Minecraft." We pushed back from the gate. It startled her. We started a taxi. She said, "Are we doing it?" I said, "Yeah, baby, we're doing it." And then the plane started to accelerate. And she said, "Are we in the air, Dad?" I said, "Look out the window." And she looked and she said, "We're flying." I said, "Yeah, baby, we're flying." 45 minutes before we landed in Orlando, the pilot came on and made this announcement. "Folks, the weather's real nice in Orlando, but between us and Orlando are some thunderstorms, and we're going to have to get through them. So everybody needs to sit down and to buckle their seatbelts, and the flight crew needs to do the same." My anxiety level spiked for Brooklyn. And then the strangest thing that's ever happened to me in a commercial flight, we didn't level off. He actually went nose down and accelerated. And my little Brooklyn went, It's just like a roller coaster.